This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and coming up in the second half of the show today, we learn about a group of students and researchers from NDSU who are looking for ways to combat the opioid epidemic. But first, days like this, and you just start craving fresh greens from the garden. Remember when you can go out and just clip your own lettuce and have a wonderful salad, and you think it's impossible in January? Well, our next guest begs to differ. Carol Ford is a program coordinator for the University of Minnesota's Extension Service for the Regional Sustainable Development Partnerships Program, and she is an expert on the topic of deep winter greenhouses, and she will be presenting on that topic at the Food and Farming Conference January 24th through 27th at the Holiday Inn in Fargo. And she's on the line from her office at the University of Minnesota in Morris. Carol, thanks for joining us today.
It's great to be here. I've really been looking forward to it.
What is a deep winter greenhouse?
Well, in a nutshell, what we wanted to do is figure out how we could grow fresh produce in the middle of winter and not have it cost an arm and a leg. Because I talked to a guy once from Alaska who said, yeah, we can grow bananas if you want to spend $200 on a banana.
Right.
So the whole idea then is to try and figure out how this can be profitable for farmers. And the way we looked at it is to turn to the sun, and so we developed some passive solar design features to the structure. And basically what it has, all passive solar needs some kind of thermal mass that stores the heat that comes in. And what we decided to do is put that thermal mass underneath the greenhouse. So there is an insulated foundation that goes around the perimeter of the greenhouse, and in that there's a couple 3 feet of rock. In that rock we have perforated drainage tile that's connected to PVC pipes that go up to the peak of the greenhouse, because we all know hot air rises, and when that heat gets to a certain point, thermostats trigger fans that pull that hot air down into that rock bed, and the perforated drainage tile helps distribute it. Then there's separate just like PVC that goes down into the rock, so that there wouldn't, it would create too much pressure if there wasn't an escape. So that lets some of that air, once it's given the rock its heat, can dissipate and come back into the greenhouse, so it creates this cycle. And then the sides and the back of the greenhouse are heavily insulated to also help keep the heat in. And the south face is twin-wall polycarbonate. And that is the basic design. It's not rocket science. And that was when my husband and I developed our first one, the whole idea was this needs to be something that anybody can do if they've got either basic carpentry skills themselves or friends that can do it. And that kind of took off. That was about 14 years ago that we built ours. And the Regional Sustainable Development Partnerships out of Minnesota Extension became interested in this and helped support us writing a manual for it. And then we, unfortunately, my husband passed away, and I started working after that with Extension on this project so that we could see ways to improve the design and improve the productivity. Because, you know, that's really bottom-line stuff for farmers. And the research that we've been doing and the outreach we've been doing has been a very satisfying tribute for me to the effort that my husband put into this until he couldn't anymore. Well, and it's been working very well. We have 5 sort of signature deep winter greenhouses around Minnesota from the top to the bottom. So we can kind of take a look at the things that we're testing, how that works, you know, for different kinds of climates, because we have several here, as you do too, I think. So
yeah.
We're trying to
several
get
in
as
a day,
much useful information as we can for people who are looking at possibly doing this.
Well, when you say part of that outreach, you will be speaking in Fargo at the 2019 Food and Farming Conference. That's coming up January 24th through the 27th at the Holiday Inn in Fargo. And, well, you gave a very nice description of the building, but a lot of people will probably want to know what this looks like. If they go to your speech, will there be an opportunity to kind of see this so, to help people understand? Yeah.
You know, everybody wants to see pictures of greenhouses in the wintertime.
Right.
They're just so enticing, and it certainly is a wonderful space to be in. And this time of year is when they really shine, because it can be, you know, minus 20 outside on a sunny day in January, mm-hmm. but in the greenhouse it can be 80 degrees. You got to watch it.
That sounds
wonderful. Because that whole structure is just designed to suck in as much warmth and light as you can. And the other piece of it that I should backtrack on is that we were always conscious of how expensive it could be to have some kind of backup heat for these things. So we tried to look at ways to reduce the need for heat. The structure is part of that, but also the kind of production we do is important, because it's, in essence, it's a cool weather greenhouse. It's not a space where you're going to be growing fruiting crops like tomatoes, everybody's size, but yeah. No tomatoes, no like peppers or cucumbers. What we're mostly growing in there are different varieties of greens. And as it turns out, nutritionally, that's one of the best things that we can have in the wintertime. And if we can get them as fresh as we can, because we're growing them right here for our neighbors, then you get the maximum nutrition out of those crops. And it turns out there's a ton of them. You know, a lot of them are green, you know, green leafy crops that are in the brassica family also. You know, like you think about cabbage and broccoli, but there's a ton more. And we also, to maximize the production in this, we do it, it's kind of a 3D thing. You're not just growing on the bottom surface of the greenhouse. We have planters that we make out of just like plastic rain gutter with end caps and holes drilled on the bottom. They can either hang from the rafters. Some people make kind of stands for them to sit on. And so we get all of that space growing crops for us. And in those gutters, we grow like 3 dozen or more different varieties of leafy greens, salad greens. And people just love them. And we grow things like, oh, the stuff that I'm eating right now that I just love is you can start very easily pea shoots. So you just, and you can even just use like field peas. And you put them into a flat with some soil. And they're just right there on the surface, so they'll sprout a little faster. And when they have, like, 4 to 6 leaves, you cut them and eat them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're juicy and sweet and so fresh and just taste like peas, you know, like spring peas. But it's this salad-y thing, and you know, you can tell I really like them. But they also grow amazingly well in there. And over the 14 years that I've been doing this, I've come up with a pretty good list of crops that really thrive in this environment and people really enjoy. I started out doing a community-supported ag thing with my greenhouse so that people were getting weekly deliveries from me of these crops, and it's always different each week because I'm constantly planting new things. As one variety gets spent, you know, you can cut them maybe 3 to 5 times depending on which one, and then fresh things are always coming in. So the salad mixes are always different. There's, you know, there's pak choy and there's chard and kale and all these different things coming in. And it's really a wide variety of produce. And it's a delightful place to work in the wintertime. That's the other perk for the farmer.
Yeah, I bet. I think that's like the cost of a vacation. You just like walk out to your backyard and all of a sudden it's 80 degrees.
Yeah, I say, who needs Florida? I got my backyard.
How much does it cost to build your own deep winter greenhouse?
You know, that's an early question for a lot of people who are researching whether they want to do this on their farm or not. It's a really good fit in a lot of different circumstances, not just like on a small, diverse farm, but also part of really any production enterprise to have an income source in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
And so much depends on the purpose of it, the location of it, and the size of it. And like mine, we started out kind of small. It was sort of a risk management thing because we didn't know if it would work or not. It did. So mine is 18 by 22. You wouldn't really want to get smaller than that, because the smaller they are, the more extreme the temperature fluctuations can be, because the airspace is so small. So you wouldn't want to go smaller than mine. But with mine, I was able to do a CSA of 12 shares. So I was feeding, and some of those were split between families, so I was feeding about 20 families out of there with all of their fresh greens needs, and they were real chompers, you know. So it's more than, you know, you might think at first, because it is so productive in there, because you're choosing the right environment, the right structure, and the right crops.
Okay.
So when I built mine, it was off the back of the garage, and we also converted half of that two-stall garage into a packing shed. And soup to nuts for the whole thing was about $18,000. And the ones that we have now are built a little bit differently, and the range on price has been huge. It was more expensive, it turns out, up north, because for them to get materials delivered costs them, you know, more than like out here on the prairie, where it just can, you know, get pulled up beside where you're going to be doing it and just dumped off.
Okay.
So I think the thing that I try to encourage people to do is to go to our website that the university provides, and it's really easy to find. You just have to Google Minnesota, D as in dog, W, G, and you'll get our website. And it has all of our research results, all of the resources that we've found while we've been doing our research. There's even the newest deep winter greenhouse design. The blueprint is there, and you can download it for free. But also, we've had a recent report come back from one of our guys who was researching the whole cost thing about the greenhouses. And he was gathering research with like 7 or 8 different greenhouses. We're still pioneers, so, you know, we're always eager to find somebody who's doing it so we can see how they're doing things and gather this kind of information that's useful for other people. And so you can go there and see what his report has to say about the economic vitality of these greenhouses, and it turns out you really can make a profit on them. And when you know what that is, and then you do your homework to figure out all of those answers to what size, what purpose, then you can start finding out like what materials are going to cost in your area. It takes some homework. Nobody's just going to drop one in your backyard and say that'll be $18,000. But, you know, for most people that come into this, it's a passion. And so all of these aspects of getting to the point where you can finally walk in there and plant some seeds is fun.
Yeah.
But what's really fun now is like when my late husband Chuck and I were doing it, we couldn't find anybody else. So we were really building a wheel. And I kept thinking that whole first year, it's like, I can't wait for the other people who start doing this, so that they don't have to figure it all out by themselves. But there is some stuff for your own unique purpose that you will. And, you know, there's some people that have decided to do it and not make money at it. They're maybe growing it for themselves and their families, maybe their neighbors. But what I try to tell them is, you know, that's a great purpose. I'm not, you know, whatever brings you to this is terrific. But remember that this thing is really productive, and it can not only do that for you, it can also pay for itself if you're going to sell your extra produce, which you will have, to other people who also want it.
We're visiting with Carol Ford. She is an expert on the topic of deep winter greenhouses. She will be speaking Saturday, January 26th at 11 a.m. at the 2019 Food and Farming Conference. And that conference is the 24th through the 27th at the Holiday Inn in Fargo. And Carol, I noticed that there is a focus on passive solar energy for the deep winter greenhouses. Why did you want to go with passive solar?
Well, it's cheap to get into.
Okay.
And you don't have to have it, and it's really low tech. It's about as low tech as you can get. And we didn't, you know, have the resources at that time to be installing active solar panels and things like that. These days, I mean, I do know some deep winter greenhouse folks who have elected to be completely off-grid, and so in addition to the passive solar design, they also have solar panels, they have wind, and, you know, they're trying a bunch of different things. It's really critical when you're trying some of these newer technologies to build in resiliencies so that, like with my greenhouse, when we were starting, our backup was just a really simple little propane furnace that kicks in if it ever gets below 40 degrees in there,
okay,
just to make sure nothing freezes up, including the water. So this is another one of those things that everyone can sort of take a look at and decide. If you've ever heard of a rocket stove, that's one that is really like I kind of am getting super interested in finding out more about if that's something that could be useful. There's pros and cons to any sort of heat source that you use, but our idea was anticipating that, you know, petroleum-based heat is going to become scarce and expensive down the road, and we wanted to see what could be the possible way to address that. Now, we've still got the backup heat with that, and others might, you know, choose different ones. This has never been a boilerplate thing. It really is about people asking themselves, is this a passion of mine, and what's it going to take for it to really fulfill those needs that I have in wanting to get into an endeavor like this? But it's really wonderful now because of all the resources that we have through the university and the research we've done to be able to answer some of those big questions, like depending on what your answers are to those questions, what is it going to cost me? What can I anticipate will be my profits? What are my different ways that I can market these products? What are the ways that I can address any growing concerns that can happen in there? I've been wanting to talk to people about this stuff for years.
Well, good thing you're going to a food and farming conference.
And to be able to do it with other people who are doing it now. Yeah. It's not just me. And they've got their own takes on it. One of our new growers found that she had a really strong market for microgreens, which I knew, you know, like my customers would never really be interested in, but she's got a hot market for it. She's getting top dollar for that product, and it's helping her get her greenhouse paid off faster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and we're visiting with Carol Ford as we learn about how to grow produce all year for lots of different farming opportunities. And we'll be back with more after this break.
Sleepy Hollow Theater and Arts Park invites you to a winter presentation of the rock musical Rent at 1603 in Bismarck, January 24th through the 26th and the 31st through February 2nd. Social hour begins at 6 p.m. Appetizers, drinks, and desserts available with table seating. Space is limited. Reservations available now online at shtap.org or by phone 701-319-0894.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and my guest today is Carol Ford. She is a program coordinator with the University of Minnesota Extension Service, specifically with the Regional Sustainable Development Partnerships, and she will be speaking at the upcoming Food and Farming Conference in Fargo, January 24th through the 27th, on the topic of deep winter greenhouses. Carol, what kinds of partnerships do you have in regards to the deep winter greenhouses?
Well, the way it works through Extension is that it has a project that's called the Regional Sustainable Development Partnerships. And what that does is it breaks the outstate away from, you know, the core of Minneapolis-St. Paul into five regions. Each one has its own set of people who are involved with a director. These partnerships decide based on the sort of different kinds of activities to enhance things that are going on in these rural areas, what they want to pursue. And it turned out all of them were interested in this deep winter greenhouse production because they're interested in a bunch of things. They want to find out ways to have sustainable energy in their regions, and they also want better food systems. And I'm guessing that the Dakotas are familiar with this notion that there's this sort of federal guideline of when an area is considered a food desert. Mm-hmm. And that's an area where people have to drive a significant number of miles to get to fresh, nutritious food.
Right.
You know, not just like stopping at the gas station or something.
Right.
And so when they saw these deep winter greenhouses, that at a small size they can be productive and they can also be upscaled, that this looks like a way where you could bring local foods right to where it's most needed. And as it turns out, that also has validity in urban areas with the same problem. So they became very interested in helping us look at how to make this idea even better. And that's what we've been pursuing through the RSDP with our research and outreach. And it's just amazing to me because I've been doing this for, you know, like 5 years now. And when we come to conferences to talk about people, it's always packed, and everybody wants to find out, what is this? How do you do it? How can I do it?
What does it do for you? Because like in each of our five partnership regions, we've had one of these new, 2.0 models of greenhouse built. And each one's a very different place. You know, up in the most northern spot in Finland, Minnesota, it's built off of part of an environmental learning center. One that we have in Bemidji is off of a community food shelf. And then we've got a couple that are at small, diverse farms. And, you know, it's just there's a whole range of ways that these can be used. And I know of several that have been built off of schools, and they can be part of the curriculum at a school. So it solves a lot of different really interesting problems for people who are trying to look at how can we have fresh food where we are in, the northern prairie plain area and have it be cost efficient. And it's so much better than whatever we get that's trucked in from, Brazil or California. And California's got its own problems right now. I really like the idea that we can take on our ability to feed ourselves in the wintertime with this terrific food. And it's a great thing to be doing in the middle of winter. And it has a real satisfaction to it for a producer because people are so excited to be able to get it.
Well, Carol, you studied creative writing and literature and thought for a little while that you might go into broadcasting even. How did you make this jump to food?
Well, that's a good question. I think my passion, my original passion, I started writing when I was in third grade. I wrote my first book back then. You can believe that. But it is a skill that I have, and so is performing. I'm also a singer and a songwriter, and I do a lot of those things. So I started working for the University of Minnesota 30 years ago in the Twin Cities and found that having a steady day job really helps you as an artist. but I always had all these other passions, and when I really wanted to live in a small town, and I fell in love with the village that I live in, Milan, when I first came and visited it, and I ended up working as editor of the newspaper here, and I just love small town life, and I was never felt quite right living in the city. I love visiting. But I wanted to live in a small town, and so I found a job at the university, and that was paying the bills. But I became a master gardener. And while I was doing that, I found some research on how they grow food up in Canada in the wintertime. And I thought, and this is when I was first dating my husband, and I said, if they can do it, why can't we do it? I really want to do this. How could we do this? And he had these old books he kept from the 70s on passive solar design, and we started looking at that and thinking, this could really work. I mean, why wouldn't this work? Why hasn't anybody done this? What are we missing here? And finally, it was like, we just got to try this. We just have to do this. And in Minnesota, the Land Stewardship Project offers a beginning farmers course that I took and did all of the, stuff you got to do. It's kind of like pulling teeth, but you got to do it. You got to figure out a business plan, and you got to find out, what is your financial source going to be? And there's a lot more of those now than there used to be. In fact, one of our guys, the one that has the totally off-grid, he paid for his solar panels through a Kickstart thing. And so that's the other thing I like to tell people is this is a creative space. When you're an entrepreneur and you're a pioneer, you can, decide that you're going to do it differently, and there's lots of choices to be made. But the more I got into it, the more I realized that there's lots of niches that this can fulfill for people who want to be able to produce this and have it fit some of their own passions. And so I just want to be out there helping to make that happen, because I want our rural areas to have the kinds of endeavors and exciting opportunities that brings some of those people in the cities who are starting to migrate back out to small communities and rural areas. There's certain things that they want to be able to have when they move out here, and, like good internet access, sure, but also they want to be able to find good quality food. And if you have something like what I've got in your small town, that's one more reason for them to pick your town to live in.
And you can learn more about all the work that Carol does on Saturday, the 26th at 11 a.m. as she speaks about growing veggies all winter in passive solar deep winter greenhouses as part of the Northern Plains Food and Farming Conference at the Holiday Inn in Fargo. The entire conference is the 24th through the 27th. Carol, thank you for your time today.
It's been my absolute pleasure, Ashley. Thanks for inviting me on.
Still to come on Main Street, we learn about tackling the opioid epidemic. But now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The state Senate has turned down bills that would have exempted the state auditor from effort to consolidate information technology services. Auditor Josh Gallion argued the consolidation could mean delays in getting repairs or changes, as well as concerns about whether confidential communications or audits could be more easily seen by others outside the agency. But Fargo Republican Senator Kyle Davison told his Senate colleagues that the state IT department has taken steps to alleviate those concerns.
They pointed out the use of centralized services has minimized the investment in staff required to support the systems, avoid duplication of investments in IT. In addition, they pointed out that they handle confidential information for many agencies across the state without any concerns.
The bills both failed on unanimous no votes. Fargo City Commissioner Dave Pepcorn attempted unsuccessfully to halt refugee resettlement over fears of tuberculosis. He questioned Fargo Cass Public Health Director Desi Fleming at last night's commission meeting as she discussed a grant to pay for interpreters for refugees under case management who have been diagnosed with TB. Fleming told commissioners there were 138 cases of TB in Cass County last year. 97% were latent cases, meaning the disease cannot be transmitted to others. Of those, 18% were refugees. There were 5 active cases in the county, and none were refugees, but Pepcorn was not convinced.
I want the health department to come up with the list of what we want to have screened, because if we don't, we are responsible. Because here's the thing. TB can kill you. And if you're an infant or a senior citizen, your immune system isn't as strong, you're the most susceptible. I'm telling you, man, this is not a joke.
Fleming and Mayor Dr. Tim Mahoney responded, telling Pepcorn all refugees coming to the U.S. are screened. Pepcorn introduced a motion to immediately suspend refugee resettlement in the city until new refugees are screened for the potentially fatal disease, but it failed without a second. Commissioners did approve the $2,400 grant for interpreters. Pepcorn was the only no vote. And a Fargo state senator has introduced a bill to provide research dollars for NDSU and UND. This comes after NDSU President Dean Brashani and UND President Mark Kennedy pushed for $100 million over the next 2 years for research. Fargo Republican Senator Ron Sorvog's bill would set aside 15% of the earnings of the legacy fund. Sorvog says he sees the value in research to diversify North Dakota's economy.
I look at it as a predominantly a research corridor in the Red River Valley. This is the raw beginning research. This isn't the commercialization of it. And it's to see if it can generate another revenue source and employment source for the state of North Dakota. It's not even going to attempt to diminish the importance of ag and energy, but down the road, we need to look at other things.
Sorvog says he knows there's a lot of demand for parts of the legacy fund earnings, but he says this is forward-looking and should be high on the priority list. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Interrupting all programs.
Hi, this is Bill Thomas at Prairie Public. If you're listening to us over the air in the Minot area, you have noticed the outages as tower crews work to build our new towers and rehang our antennas. High winds and cold temperatures slow them down. I think they hope their next job will be south of here. We appreciate your patience. We're still there on your desktop or mobile app or in a smart speaker, and we will finish up and be back to a normal on-air service as soon as possible.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And in the news this week, the headline that opioid deaths, there are more deaths from opioids now than car accident deaths in the United States. And we are joined in studio by Allison Brennan. She is a research associate who is working with about 24 other researchers on opioids and the epidemic and working on some possible solutions. Allison, thank you for joining me today.
Glad to be here.
For anyone who might not know, how do opioids work?
Well, so just to begin, I think it's good to start with a definition of what are opioids, right? Mm-hmm. Because this term gets used a lot, and I don't think everybody necessarily knows what it means. And so opioids are that's an umbrella term that refers to opiates, which are the naturally derived products of the opium poppy. So that would be things like heroin, right, the mm-hmm. natural substance, and then opioids includes opiates, okay. As well as the synthetics. And a lot of people, I think, are a lot more familiar with synthetics, and that would include things like fentanyl or oxycodone, right? These are drugs that are synthesized in a lab, which is a different sort of deal than opiates. Mm-hmm. But so when the term opioids is used, it really refers to all of those drugs.
Okay.
And opioids are used to treat pain. Mm-hmm. So they can be prescribed to treat acute pain. So let's say you go to you go and get your wisdom teeth removed. You might receive a prescription to treat some of the pain associated with that.
Mm-hmm.
They are more typically prescribed for chronic kinds of pain, and they're also used a lot with terminal patients to manage pain in people who are end of life. And really, they're a drug that they work on what are called, without getting too technical, they work on some of these natural pain relief pathways that already exist in the brain, but they also can trigger some dopamine release. And so they have a high potential for addiction because of the fact that they stimulate these dopaminergic pathways.
Okay. So that's like when your brain really
right.
feels good.
Yes.
And so the addiction there is because pleasure seeking, basically. Is that fair to say?
Well, yeah. So it gets pretty complicated, but it works on the brain in a similar way that a lot of substances do.
Okay.
In stimulating the reward system of the brain, and that involves the dopamine. And so people who have different kinds of personalities, that there are certain traits that predispose people towards becoming addicted, and some of those would be thrill-seeking or attention-seeking, right? Really their brain being highly responsive to reward and especially to external forms of reward.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are there brain scans? Like, I'm just picturing a brain on some kind of opioid. Like, do you know? Have you seen that brain
light? I have
not.
I have not. But I am certain that that's out there, because now that we have fMRI, we can actually see, psychologists and doctors, medical mm-hmm. professionals can actually see in real time the way that the brain is functioning with fMRI. So I'm certain that it would be feasible to have somebody take an opioid and see what that does in the brain.
You are part of a work group that is studying opioid addiction and possible solutions and strategies for fighting opioids. So let's just start off the bat. When you say opioids, are you talking both the natural, the heroin, and the
synthetics?
Synthetics, thank you. Or
yes.
Are you focusing just on the synthetics, because those are the ones that are legally prescribed?
It's everything. So it's not that there's just one problem when we talk about the opioid crisis. There's a whole conglomeration of issues at play here. And a lot of it does begin with the synthetics that have been prescribed by a medical doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And those can often serve as a gateway for people to start using heroin, but not necessarily. So there are a lot of pathways into opioid misuse and
okay.
into heroin use. And so most people who take a prescription opioid do not go on to become addicted or to use heroin. But among people who use heroin, there's a disproportionate number who first were hooked on a prescription opioid.
Okay. And in this area, for the people that you are studying and your work will impact, are you seeing most of it because of the illegal drugs or the legal drugs?
it's the legal.
Right.
It's the misuse of, well, I have to be careful in how I say that. What typically will happen is somebody gets prescribed an opioid from their doctor, and then a couple of different things can happen. They can either become addicted themselves due to use over a period of time. So maybe they start taking too much, or they're using it for a very long period of time. And so they could become addicted and then need more because they'll experience.
Is there a tolerance buildup too?
Yes.
Or,
Okay. And actually part of that tolerance buildup actually makes them more sensitive to pain, which is really strange. So not only do they build up a tolerance for the medication, but when they don't have the medication, their perception of the pain is intensified. So there's two different things going on there. And so that can lead a lot of people into chronic use and into the kinds of behaviors that are indicative of a problem, such as doctor shopping or so going around and trying to find a physician who will write you a prescription or trying to obtain leftover medications from friends and family or even purchasing online because there are online pill mills that do sell. Yeah. And so that's one way that people start to experience problems. Another is recreational users that so people, when they get a prescription, often don't use it all, and then they leave it sitting around for long periods of time, and they're not even – they don't even remember that they had it, right? So they've got all these bottles, half-used bottles of pills sitting around, and maybe their teenager takes those out of the cabinet, or maybe a friend of the family comes over and finds them and takes a few, right? So, or maybe they share them. Maybe they have a friend or a family member who's in a lot of pain and they say, oh, hey, I've got these pills from when I had my wisdom teeth out. Do you want these? And so that's how it can begin. So even when people think that they're helping and it's really a benign sort of use, it can still lead to problems.
Well, and I would think, too, with a number of opioids being prescribed to terminal patients, there's a likelihood there that not all this prescription is going to be used before the end of that patient's life.
Right. So then where do those prescriptions go?
Right.
If hospice is involved, they probably get dealt with correctly.
Okay.
But it's hard to say.
Does your working group work with the doctors?
You know, I don't know that we actually have consulted with any medical professionals. It's mostly at this point people who are involved in mental health research or family science or prevention science, right? A lot of it at this point is faculty at different universities as well as extension staff who are community-based educators. So it's really more the education side than it is medical.
So what does the work group do?
Well, there was a whole process involved here. When we assembled, we really wanted to understand, the focus was on how can land-grant institutions be a part of solving the crisis. So a lot of that is education and prevention. So really what we started with was discovering what is already being done within extension, what's already being done in the land-grant system. And so we did an extension behavioral health program survey that we sent out to all land grants across the nation to find out anything and everything that they do related to mental health, not just opioids, but related to mental or behavioral health more broadly. And that could include education or prevention focused on opioids, and just to kind of get a lay of the land as far as what's the most common sort of program being done, and then to get a feel for what's the capacity within the land grant system to address some of these challenges. And that was where we started. And then we did a lot more on the side of determining a strategic framework that we could use to guide us in trying to implement some of these solutions.
Okay. And within the work group are researchers from Kentucky, Virginia, Delaware, North Carolina, Missouri, Iowa, Pennsylvania, Guam. Does your research get to be North Dakota specific at all? Are you able to really focus in you here on behalf of the North Central Regional Center for Rural Development?
I wouldn't say that it's been very North Dakota specific, but as part of the NCRCRD, that's a 12-state region that involves the Great Plains Strip. So I've really been attentive to the kinds of activities that are going on in this region, and really, as much as I can, serving as a connector for NDSU Extension staff who might want to work on these issues. And really just keeping my eyes and ears open with regard to different initiatives that are going on in North Dakota, and kind of keeping tabs on what are the numbers here.
We're visiting with Allison Brennan. She is a research associate and a member of a working group that is studying the opioid epidemic in the United States. Allison, are there differences between rural and urban communities when it comes to opioid addiction and abuse?
Yes. So the opioid crisis has disproportionately affected rural areas, and there's a number of reasons for that. One of the big ones has to do with manual labor occupations. So because there's a lot more manual labor occupations in rural areas, there's a lot more chronic pain issues, so greater number of prescriptions per capita than in other places. Also, older populations, so there's aging populations who have problems like arthritis. Again, that's a chronic pain issue and may involve taking opioids. And then there are some issues related to, so there's the overprescribing that can also occur in rural areas. But then there are issues in terms of accessing health services, especially mental health services. And so not being able to access the kinds of mental health services that are required to treat some of the underlying conditions that actually contribute to the problem. And then specifically, not a lot of options for treatments for substance use disorders.
Yeah, our guest yesterday talked about the same thing in specific to stress that farmers face, and one of the major compounding factors is they might be two and a half hours away from a city that would have some behavioral health concern specialists.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. That's common. Yeah, the geographic isolation contributes quite a lot. It also contributes to problems with overdose. So not just seeking services, treatment, you know, to try to kick an opioid use problem, but when people have these problems and they take too much and they overdose, it really creates a problem for emergency services getting to them in a timely fashion. And so it becomes extremely important that family members and friends of people who are using opioids, that they have access to Narcan, that they have access to that reversal drug.
All right. How does Narcan work?
So Narcan, if taken at the right time, it blocks the ability of the opioid drug to bind to the receptors. So it actually interferes with that and makes it so that that person, that it blocks the overdose.
Okay. How would you describe the access to Narcan in this area?
I'm not sure about the details. I know that just anecdotally, I've heard that it's very difficult to access in rural areas. And even in the more urban areas of the Midwest, there can be issues with access. It really all depends on policy, right? Are there policies in place that make it possible for people to obtain that? And then I think awareness. I don't know that a lot of people are aware that they can obtain that medication.
What is the overarching goal of the working group?
Well, we started just focused on opioids. We really were trying to discern some of the ways that land-grant institutions could be involved in addressing the opioid crisis. But we've really transitioned now to thinking more broadly about what is the role of extension in behavioral health, particularly in prevention, because right now the problem is opioids, but in the future it's likely to be something else,
well,
right?
It used to be meth, and before that it was crack.
So it's when we are thinking about substance use disorders. It's unlikely that they're going to go away, that we're going to eradicate them, right? That if we figure out solutions for one drug, we're going to see some problems with another drug come up. And I think a lot of that comes back to that prevention and to addressing the underlying conditions like anxiety and depression and PTSD and so forth. So until you are doing enough to address those, which really requires a systems level perspective, not just thinking about the individual who is diagnosed with something, but what is their family context? What is their neighborhood context? What kind of a society do we have? Do we have access to services that we need, right? So you have to think beyond the individual.
What kind of outreach are you doing?
Well, we were waiting for approval of the report. There was a meeting in the fall, back in October, where the team convened again to think about moving forward with the project. What do we do with that? And so at this point, what we've really done is made the resources that we've compiled available on the website, and as much as possible through our networks, have tried to make program leaders at various institutions aware of these resources, aware of possible programs they could be involved with, and just open to answering questions and pointing people in the right direction.
Okay. And that website is opioidresponse.extension.org. Allison, where do you hope that this goes, this work?
My hope is that it really opens a dialogue about broader behavioral health issues and serves to address some of the stigma surrounding mental health and especially substance use disorders, and that we can start thinking and acting more as a society in the way of prevention. So instead of thinking about treating conditions after they occur and channeling all kinds of money into treatment services, into incarceration, that's another issue. The amount of money that gets spent on incarceration for people who are there to a large degree because they have substance use disorders. And incarceration is much more expensive than prevention.
We have about a minute left. How did you get into this line of work?
Well, prior to my postdoc, I worked for NDSU Extension Service. I was a parent educator in Cass County. And so, I did work with some families who were affected by substance use disorders, and not just opioids, but more broadly things like alcohol and all kinds of dependence issues, and really seeing how that impacts parents and how that impacts their relationship with their child and their functioning in the home context, and also their ability to do things like maintain a job, right? So seeing some of this firsthand it's different to read about it in an article and then to see it in front of you, right? I think that you really, when you see it happen in front of you, you're much more compelled to be involved.
Allison, thank you for your time today.
You're welcome.
Dr. Allison Brennan is a postdoctoral research associate and member of a working group studying opioid deaths and strategies for fighting the opioid epidemic. Dakota Datebook is next.
From Minnesota to Alaska, 8 rappers bring insight and emotional rawness in exploring disconnection and reconnection to Native culture. We hear personal stories that cover addiction, identity, boarding schools, and generational trauma.
I want to help preserve this language by bringing it to hip-hop.
We have to remember those seeds to our existence that have always been there.
These artists' powerful lyrical and artistic expression works to uplift their communities and inspire youth. In a 4-part radio series, we hear the dynamic stories of these Native American hip-hop MCs. This is Definition of Resilience, a special from Indigify, brought to you by Native Voice One.
Coming up Sunday afternoon at 5 Central, 4 Mountain Time on Prairie Public Presents.
This is Dakota Datebook for January 15th. Sunshine laws guarantee public access to information about the meetings and records of public agencies. By the 1970s, all 50 states had adopted sunshine laws. And it was on this date in 1975, following the Watergate scandal, that the Government in the Sunshine Act was introduced in the Senate. It would become law the following year. North Dakota has always been far ahead of the Sunshine Law movement. In 1872, well before statehood, a Dakota Territory law provided for printing township meeting minutes in newspapers. Starting in 1874, counties were required to publish minutes of board meetings. An 1887 law addressed city councils, requiring that they shall sit with open doors and shall keep a journal of their own proceedings. When representatives of North and South Dakota met in 1889 to work out the details of dividing Dakota Territory into two states, they voted down a motion to hold the proceedings behind closed doors. When the North Dakota State Constitution was approved by voters, a provision required the state legislature to hold open meetings. In 1957, the various provisions regarding open meetings and records were condensed into one statute. It was plain by that time that North Dakotans were going to insist on access to public records. Laws passed in other states often limited access to certain records identified by law. North Dakota chose to require all meetings and records to be open unless a law specifically allowed them not to be open. In 1975, North Dakota was the first state to put open meetings and records in the state constitution. That amendment was overwhelmingly approved by the voters. Changes to the Open Meetings and Records Law were passed in 1997 to incorporate decisions by the courts and attorneys general. But the law continues to adhere to the spirit of the original 1872 legislation. Meetings and records are presumed to be open unless specifically exempted. Over the years, there have been some half-hearted attempts to tighten that access, but North Dakotans have refused to give in. Today, the citizens of the state enjoy broader access to public meetings and records than almost any other state. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Now that they're not being paid, many federal workers are taking on second jobs.
You do what you have to do once you're, you know, you cannot go to work and they lock you out of your office.
Some are using the partial government shutdown as an opportunity to pursue other passions.
Next thing you know, I'm getting certified as an EMT, I'm sitting on an ambulance, and it brings me lots of joy.
Shutdown Moonlighting on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we're joined by Joseph McNeil Jr. He will be the featured speaker at a Martin Luther King Day observance in Bismarck. And his father played a key role in igniting a youth-led movement to challenge racial inequality throughout the South. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.